That border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is very familiar to Greg Mortensen. He just spent 5 weeks traveling through both countries. Greg Mortensen is a former mountaineer and soldier who stumbled into Pakistan in 1993 after summiting K2. Since then, through his nonprofit Central Asia Institute, he's built 78 schools in the area. And he co-wrote a best-selling book about that time called Three Cups of Tea. He's consulted with everyone from anti-war groups to heads of state to top American generals. A couple of weeks ago, he had brunch with Pervez Musharraf just days before Pakistan's president stepped down. Greg Mortensen has had a long history with Musharraf.
In 1999, after President Musharraf took power in the military coup, the army contacted us to start building schools along the line of control, which is the Pakistan-India war zone. That started a long-term relationship with our organization of getting support by also the Pakistan military to set up schools. And President Musharraf a week ago invited me he said he wanted a cup of tea, and I spent about 3.5 hours just talking with him about his legacy. At the time, he seemed fairly resigned to the fact that he didn't mention he was going to resign, but he was kind of reminiscing about mm-hmm. his history and also the many positive things that he had done for his country.
Whatever one thinks of Pervez Musharraf's actions within the last year, he was a reliable American ally for a very long time. The U.S. gave him billions of dollars to fight terrorism. Do you think it worked?
President Musharraf did significant things after he came into power in 99. He sent out audit teams to every single village and hamlet in Pakistan to discern the education, animal husbandry, health care, and all the different types of social services. And for that, the people were happy. And in 2004, Pakistan also received $1 billion from the U.S. with the condition of two terms. One is to have elections, and number two, to send 70,000 troops in the tribal areas of western Pakistan to flush and rout out al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And what happened in the 2004 elections was that the MMA, the extremist coalition, got about 18% of the vote. And so by forcing an election, we galvanized the extremist coalition, and Musharraf lost a significant amount of his power, and he had to form a coalition with his nemesis parties, the People's Party and the Muslim League. What's interesting, though, Jackie, is that now the MMA has lost credibility with the people and the populace, because the people have turned against them because they haven't provided basic social services, education, health care to the people in the rural areas.
Speaking of what people in these tribal and rural areas want, the areas in which you have so much expertise, what do they want? You're asked that at the highest levels. You'll be meeting next month with Army General David Petraeus. You'll be addressing the British House of Commons in October. And you've experienced this violence firsthand. You were kidnapped yourself by the Taliban, threatened with death in a couple of fatwas. And you're trying to put schools in these areas that are this hostile and this volatile. How do you do that?
We build relationships over many, many years with tribal chiefs, with the mullahs, with the imams, with the tribal leaders. And I find pretty much as a whole, people really want education. Recently, about early 2007, I started getting correspondence from U.S. military commanders in the field in Afghanistan who had read Three Cups of Tea. And I find that I think our military leaders have actually come a very long ways, and they're in some terms ahead of the State Department and the White House in that many of those commanders have been in Afghanistan or Iraq 3 or 4 times, and they really understand that it's imperative that with any type of strategy, first and foremost is building relationships with the people.
Greg, this has been a week in which editorials have been sounding the alarm about Afghanistan, and the news of these deaths and military operations have hit the front pages. Does this make you feel disappointed? Does this make you feel apprehensive? Or do you see any sense of hope here?
Well, it's disappointing, but it's also inspiring. In 2003, when the Iraq War started, there was a mass exit of U.S. interest, the media, the military, the aid to Iraq. And I think we also should appreciate the fact that it was the Mujahideen, or the Afghan freedom fighters, who eventually brought down the Soviet Union during the Cold War, which was our objective, you know, in the 80s under President Reagan. And they feel that they've been abandoned. And so in some ways, I think it's good that there's been another arrow pointing back at Afghanistan and also in Pakistan.
Greg Mortensen is the co-author of the book Three Cups of Tea, and he's executive director of the Central Asia Institute. Greg, thanks very much for being with us, and thanks for your work.
Thanks, Jackie.
You can see a picture of Greg Mortensen during his visit with Pervez Musharraf and hear an earlier interview I did with him for the Kentucky Author Forum on our website, npr.org.
Tito Puente turned out 118 records, more than 2,000 musical arrangements, and more than 10,000 live performances. It was a career that started when he was just a high school student in Spanish Harlem, or El Barrio, as it was and still is known. Tito Puente lived it up. He played it loud during the big band heydays of the last century. When rock and roll seduced the jazz audience, Tito Puente formed smaller jazz ensembles and continued to garner awards and acclaim, including Grammy Awards in the 70s and 80s. Late in life, the king of Latin music even played himself, playing percussion on The Simpsons. And your El Diablo con dinero. Tito Puente died 8 years ago this past June at the age of 77. Joining us from New York to talk about Tito Puente is another distinguished percussionist and band leader, Bobby Sanabria. Recently, Bobby's big band won a Jazz Journalists Association Award for their latest album, Big Band Urban Folk Tales. Bobby, nice to talk to you again.
Great being here, Scott. Hello to everyone listening.
What made Tito Puente the king of Latin music?
Well, I mean, Tito Puente is one of the most important musicians in any genre in the 20th century. I would put him up there with Stravinsky, Leonard Bernstein, Jimi Hendrix, et cetera, et cetera. Not only was he an incredible percussionist, but he was a fabulous composer and arranger. I don't think people realize the depth of this man's musicianship. 90% of what you would hear being played by his big band was either written by him and or arranged by him.
The album we're talking about today is a self-titled record, Tito Puente and his concert orchestra. Let's talk about the first cut on this album, El Rey del Timbal. This is quite a boast to make, isn't it?
To say that and to prove that and demonstrate it was a really phenomenal thing. This is a reworking.
I'm the king of the timbal.
Exactly.
I am the law, he says, right?
Yo soy la ley, yeah.
Now, to understand, to use an old Latin American expression, the chutzpah, involved in I'm the king of the timbales, I own the law, the percussionist in most jazz bands is way in the back.
Right, the drummer is usually in the back of a big band. But what Tito did with his orchestra is he put the percussion up front, the conga, the bongo, and himself on the timbales in the front. Now, that served the dual purpose. He could cue the orchestra, and it also served as a symbol that he was the leader of the band to the audience and that he was the law as far as it was concerned.
A little background on Tito Puente. He was essentially a professional musician when he was in high school, wasn't he?
Right. He was working locally with various small groups, etc. And then his first break was with the Jose Curbelo Orchestra when he was a young kid.
Essentially dropped out of high school, played with Machito's band. World War II came along. He was drafted, served in the Navy. And then after the war, went to Juilliard.
He studied piano for about 8 years when he was a kid. And he studied drum set with a Mr. Williams, an African-American show drummer in Harlem. Mm-hmm. Then later on, he started studying clarinet and saxophone, and he went to the Navy School of Music. People don't know this, but he was in the Battle of Midway, the Battle of Guadalcanal. So he's part of American history as far as World War II is concerned.
Forgive me, he just wasn't playing the timbale at Midway, was he?
No, he was in those days in the on all the battleships and on all the aircraft carriers. They would have musicians to keep morale up on the ship. He also played piano during mess hall, and he was the ship's bugler. Very funny story once. He was warming up, and he didn't know that the microphone was on, and he started playing General Quarters, which means battle stations, and he just to warm up. And all of a sudden, he looks around, and the whole ship is going into a frenzy. And the captain all of a sudden goes on the loudspeaker, "Puente, get down here!" You know.
Ooh.
Very interesting career he had. I mean, in the Navy, he played alto saxophone in the ship's big band, and occasionally he would play drums, and he was a gunner's mate.
I wonder if some of that Juilliard training doesn't come through in a clip we want to play now, Ritual Fire Dance.
Right, the great orchestral composition by Manuel de Falla. Mm-hmm. I think Tito's Juilliard training came out in all of the things that he did. This is a great example of his knowledge of Afro-Cuban rhythm and his knowledge of the orchestra.
Let's listen to a little bit of Ritual Fire Dance, Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra. Now to compare and contrast, Tito Puente and his concert orchestra. Now, what's going on here, Bobby? What do you hear?
Well, there's a great combination of a rock happening with the drum set, and then at the same time, you hear that cowbell playing that pattern, which is part of the carnival conga de comparsa rhythm from Cuba. And then on top of that, you have the horns coming in, particularly the trombones muted, doing a wah-wah effect, and then the beautiful lead trumpet sound, etc. And now we're in 6-8 bembe rhythm, which directly comes from West Africa. Now it's cha-cha-cha.
There's a lot going on here, isn't there?
Right, right.
What were his live performances like?
Well, anybody that has seen him live can attest that he was the most exciting performer on the planet. I mean, he drew you in. He was
That's
a showman.
That's quite a statement, Bobby.
Yeah, he was a showman. And if you were lucky enough to see a show, experience a show where he would play vibes and or marimba, it was even more exciting.
I want to finish up with a composition called Picadillo.
Right, right.
One of Tito Puente's earliest compositions. Now, he named it after, he had a band called the Piccadilly Boys?
The original name of Tito Puente's first group was the Piccadilly Boys. A promoter kind of gave him that name to sort of cross over into the so-called Anglo-American market.
Picadillo becomes Piccadilly.
Picadillo is actually shredded Cuban beefsteak. It's a dish.
Yeah.
Now, this piece was recorded in the late 1940s, and what's interesting about the piece, it uses what we call in music voicing in fourths. There's an interval of a fourth in the way he comps on the marimba. That interval hadn't been explored at all, really, in Latin American music, especially and particularly in Afro-Cuban music. So it's very progressive from that standpoint. So he takes this tune he wrote in the late 40s and redoes it again, and listen to the power and the majesty of it.
Why has this song endured? It's such a standard piece now.
Well, it's because it's so driving and funky. I mean, as soon as you hear it, you want to dance mambo right away. In Afro-Cuban music, we've inherited this concept of being possessed by the music on the dance floor. The same thing happens, used to happen in jazz with the great Lindy Hop dancers that used to dance at the Savoy and reacted to the music of Chick Webb and Duke Ellington and all the great swinging bands back there. Well, we have this concept that goes way back farther in terms of having a spiritual experience on the dance floor. And when you hear the power of this band coming at you like a tidal wave, and with those rhythms, you know, percolating, and it excites the human organism to its utmost. It's like being in ecstasy. I'm not saying it's better than sex, but it's close to it.
I think we all need to take a deep breath and let me thank you.
It's always a pleasure, Scott.
Bobby Sanabria joins us from New York. He's featured in the PBS documentary From Mambo to Hip Hop, A South Bronx Tale, that's out on DVD next month. You're pretty good yourself, Bobby.
Thanks for the opportunity again, Scott, to share this great, majestic music that's so much not only a part of the history of New York, but the history of all of us as Americans. Long live Maestro Tito Puente.
And you can hear full songs from Tito Puente and his concert orchestra on NPR Music at npr.org. This is a weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Another week, another Bigfoot hoax. Frozen body bought from two men in Georgia who claimed they'd come across a deceased Bigfoot turned out to be just a rubber gorilla suit with a few animal guts hanging out. By now, missing link academics have had a bit of experience sifting through hoaxes. So we have decided to turn to a scientist who studies such bipedal hijinks. Jeffrey Meldrum is a professor of anatomy and biological sciences at Idaho State University. His latest book is Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science. You refer to it as an interesting and mysterious phenomenon, which seems to leave open the question as to whether or not it's real.
Well, of course, I'm not advocating the existence of Sasquatch. I'm saying there is a growing body of evidence that strongly suggests that there may in fact be an animal out there. I think it's irresponsible of the scientific community to just turn their nose up at this because of its past association as a tabloid subject.
What is the evidence?
The body of evidence that has the greatest impact on me, given my expertise, is the footprint evidence. And I don't mean somebody with crude carved wooden feet strapped to their boots tromping around in the mud. I mean tracks such as those that I examined back in 1996, a long line of tracks that were very animated, that showed all the signs of a living foot, tension cracks, pressure ridges, drag-ins, drag-outs, movements of the toes. I mean, I'm not saying that it's impossible to hoax, but to do it in a manner that I witnessed would have taken a great deal of sophistication.
I've heard it said over the years that they've never found, how do I put this nicely, a Bigfoot deposit.
I mean, we don't. There wasn't a little label attached to it saying this was left by Sasquatch, but nevertheless there have been enigmatic scats, we call them, that are in volume and diameter far in excess of known wildlife. We haven't had a good sample that we could glean DNA from, but that would be an important step.
Professor Meldrum, in this day, you've got Google Maps of the entire world, you've got drones, you've got infrared lenses. Why is it not possible to find a creature like this if he actually exists?
Well, people think that there's a silver bullet like a drone or an infrared camera or a thermal imager. They don't realize the density and the extent of the wilderness out to here, particularly here in the western United States. The canopy of a coniferous forest doesn't allow a heat signature to penetrate, despite all the movies you may have seen. It's not a matter of, well, if the government just turned a satellite to look for it, we'd be able to pick it out. I don't think that could be accomplished.
Jeffrey Meldrum, professor of anatomy and biological studies at Idaho State. His latest book is Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science. May all your scat discoveries be pleasant.
Try not to step in it.
This is NPR News.
Johnny Flynn is a descendant of Shakespeare and Bob Dylan. His command of words shows he has the ear of a poet and the mind of a storyteller. The 25-year-old South African-born Brit is making his American debut with the album A Larum. Here's a bit of the song The Rote and the Rent.
I soon forget what was never there. Your words are ash and dust. All that's left is a song I've sung, the breath I've taken and the one I must. If you're born with a love for the rote and the writ, people of letters, your warning stands clear. Pay heed to your heart and not to your wit. Don't say in a letter what you can't in my ear.
Johnny Flynn joins me now from London. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Fine, thanks. So where does the title of the album come from? And then there's a space, Larum.
Well, apparently it's a word that was the origin for the word alarm. And it's kind of, I probably first saw it used in Shakespeare texts when as a stage direction. It sometimes says alarum off, meaning there's some kind of ruckus or noise going on off stage. So I quite like the idea that the noise happening off stage was this album.
Until fairly recently, you were acting on the stage more than playing music and writing music. You toured with an all-male Shakespearean theatre troupe called Propeller. Was there any sonnet or any play that really found its way into sort of the consciousness behind your own writing?
Yeah, definitely. I've been particularly affected by characters in Shakespeare's plays that have held the kind of true voice of the play or even of the author. You feel maybe like Feste in Twelfth Night or even Hamlet. But there's always those kind of luminary figures that that seem to speak the truth, and the whole play seems to be around them in a way.
Fell far from grace, so far I couldn't see. You know, underground, I wasn't that far from the tree. We're all digging if you want to know. Fixing digging far too slow. Far too slow.
I guess I started writing poetry and stuff and then decided to try and set it to music. And I wanted the lyrical aspect to be in the tradition of lyrical verse, but then to be about ever contemporary issues.
You have a song on this CD called Hong Kong Cemetery, and I think that alludes to your grandfather and sort of the larger rambling of your family.
Yeah, that was written when we were on tour with the play, actually. We went to Hong Kong, and although I'd never met him, my grandfather, because he died in 1952, I visited his grave, which is in Hong Kong Cemetery, which is this incredible place that goes up the mountain.
There are 10,000 graves in Hong Kong Protestant Cemetery. Every one of them says, born and died, and the rest might be history. Walking there, I cry. For my love was there to lie. I never knew the shade to be so refreshing.
The songs are kind of musing on what it was like for my father at the time of his death and the sort of generational divide and skipping generations.
I am the bus driver, give me some grace. You never see me and you don't know my face.
Johnny Flynn, you're obviously drawn to writing and the itinerant life. Would you tell me the story behind this song, Shore to Shore?
Yeah, well, it was a tragic accident that I read about in the newspaper and kind of kept, you know, did that thing of cutting out the clipping. This girl called Blessing was hit by a number 12 bus it's the same bus route that I used to get when I lived in South London. And her father happened to be the bus driver of a number 12 bus, several back behind the actual bus that killed his daughter. And he heard about it on the tannoy over the buses and sent his other daughter down to see if all her siblings were okay, because it was near the school where they all went. And of course she went and found out that it was her sister.
I've been waiting an hour and the bus hasn't come. I've been cursing my God for the lack of a son. I've been ruined by destiny, lowered by fate. And the upshot of this is I'm going to be late, to be late, to be late.
It was quite a shocking story to read about, and I was trying to kind of place it within, or work out how we're supposed to place tragedy like that in our heads and in our sense of how the world works and in terms of our faith and compassion and stuff like that.
I like this image of clipping something from the paper as opposed to reading it online. Do you keep a diary, or do you find that your lyrics and your thoughts go into your songwriting?
I keep a notebook. It's full of observations and things. Recording things, usually in verse.
Would you happen to have your journal with you, by any chance?
Yeah.
Would you mind sharing something from it with us?
Okay. I'll just read you. This is just what I wrote on the bus on the way here. Reams of stories reeled me in, cocked my ear and hooked my chin. A Friday dinner, a fish struck sinner, pull me down, Lord, put me in. Give me faith and give me love, a feigning from the clouds above. The sea below lends string to bow. If I can't jump, just push and shove. And I'll be in, a happy one, a lucky, running, changing sun, a lost and found, the newest sound, bullet from a golden gun. Here I lie, a dying in bed, it's time for me and death to wed. I'll taste the loam, I'm to the loam, and with a breath, my body's dead.
Excuse me, you wrote that on the bus on the way to this interview?
Yeah.
Well, you just might have a career ahead of you.
All right, thanks.
That's absolutely beautiful. It reminds me, I see poets wandering the Lake District and writing down, you know, like Coleridge and Wordsworth used to do, and it's just lovely.
Thank you.
Let's listen to another song.
Okay.
This one's called The Box, the Song of a Vagrant.
Rob lives in a box by the rails. Only thing he knew is he don't fail. When you live in a box by the rails, don't comb your hair, don't comb your tail.
I read that this was inspired by Henry David Thoreau's Walden.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. You know, the idea that we are, you know, so sort of perfectly contained within ourselves, and then yet somehow our thoughts and energies kind of extend to all we possess and think we possess. And Thoreau was, you know, saying that somewhere along the line we'd gone horribly wrong in collecting all this stuff. And, you know, and he went and lived as a hermit and carried out these sort of thought experiments. And it was really that whole thing set to a story, basically, in a song.
You're coming to the U.S. for your first tour this fall, and we looked up your schedule. You'll be stopping near Thoreau's old stomping grounds near Concord in Massachusetts. Are you going to pay a visit?
Well, yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know that we were coming here, so maybe I will. That would be nice.
Johnny Flynn's new album is called A Larum. It's been wonderful talking with you. Good luck on this tour, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sweep my mess away, leave my body, leave my bones, leave me whole and leave my soul, leave me nothing I don't need at all.
If you send children to camp this summer, you might have a few expectations that they would make new friends, have fun, maybe get a few freckles. But how about a 9-year-old learning how to make biodiesel fuel or insulate a house with recycled materials? Do they charge union rates? NPR's Jenny Gold reports on a Maryland camp that's putting a green twist on summer.
C-A-L-L-E-V-A!
C-A-L-L-E-V-A!
Camp Galena starts today!
A
typical day at Camp Kaleva for most campers includes rafting, kayaking, or rock climbing. But this group, part of a program called Building Green, has another kind of adventure in mind.
All right, Building Green, don't forget to grab all your stuff. This is our stuff.
12 campers file off the bus, carrying brown bag lunches, hammers, handsaws, and drills. They're spending their week of summer camp learning about green design and alternative energy. Last year, the group built composting toilets in a treetop classroom. This year, they're building a new environmentally friendly office for the camp. The construction site is on the other side of a creek, so the kids start the day with a trip across in a rickety wooden raft. They load up their gear and climb aboard. Two little girls jump into the water and hang off the edge of the raft, kicking their legs to propel it forward. They could have just taken the bus a little further to get to the same place. But the most important thing here is being green, even if it takes a while to reach the shore. When they finally get there, the kids leap off the raft and get to work.
A little faster on the trigger, a little faster on the trigger. Okay, and then just follow that line.
That's Omar Hakim, or Mo as the kids call him. With one master's degree in architecture and another in environmental sustainability, he's in charge of the project. Some of this is real manual labor, and the kids' parents are paying close to $500 a week. But once a week, and today is that special day, the kids move beyond their jobs building green and into the world of alternative fuel. So after lunch, they head over to the reactor room. That's the barn where Kaleva turns leftover cooking oil from restaurants in the nearby downtown of Poolsville into actual biodiesel used to fuel camp vehicles.
You know what? You can grow any type of oil to run in a diesel engine.
Matt Markoff is a Kaleva camp director turned biodiesel wizard.
Right now we're making biodiesel, which is diesel made out of vegetable oil that they make French fries. You guys like French fries?
Right now, Markoff makes about 100 gallons a week here. That's enough to fuel the Kaleva farm equipment and a couple of trucks. But with bigger biodiesel machinery on the way, Markoff thinks he'll be able to triple that.
The goal is that next year, we will be able to run 20% of all the fuel that we use will be biodiesel.
Including the camp's fleet of 20 buses. The kids can't help much here in the reactor room because the chemicals are toxic. But Markoff wants them to understand exactly how this process works.
Do you guys want to pump some grease?
Yeah!
All right, come on in here.
Awesome.
First, he explains, they gather waste vegetable grease from restaurants and pump it into the processing tank. They heat the oil to 130 degrees Fahrenheit and test a sample to find out how much lye and methanol they have to add to turn the grease into fuel.
11 grams of my catalyst to every liter of grease. You guys get that?
The oil and catalysts are mixed, allowed to separate, and then...
Up top is biodiesel. Beautiful, clear, gorgeous biodiesel.
They move the crude biodiesel to the wash tank, where it's rinsed with rainwater, and aerated in the drying tank. The kids are captivated.
Vegetable oil is converted into fuel that can be run on all diesel engines, which is pretty cool.
15-year-old Jacob Galesian is one of the oldest kids in Building Green.
It is kind of complicated. A few stuff went right over my head, but I got the basics.
And that kind of response is exactly what Mo is looking for. The kids aren't just having fun, he says. They're also learning.
Well, surprisingly enough, you know, kids come back and they go, oh, do you remember when you were telling us about how much water infiltrates through turf grass? And I was like, I can't believe you remember that.
Matt Markoff says Building Green and the biodiesel project are going to help the whole camp become more energy independent.
When they get on a Kaleva bus and they drive to camp and it smells like French fries, and, you know, then, I mean, we are very much going to make it aware that our, you know, buses are running on biodiesel.
By next summer, just riding the bus at Camp Kaleva will be a greening experience. Jenny Gold, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. 2 years ago, Noriel Roubini was called a madman for some of his economic predictions. Now he's being called prophetic. At an International Monetary Fund conference in September 2006, the New York University professor warned of a developing mortgage crisis, bankruptcies among hedge funds and investment banks, and soaring oil prices. His audience thought he was being alarmist. Now fellow economists and finance ministers across the globe are starting to listen to Professor Roubini. He's been invited to speak to members of Congress, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the World Economic Forum. He was also the subject of an admiring profile in last Sunday's New York Times, headlined Dr. Doom. Noriel Roubini joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure being with you.
You say we're in a recession, and to deny that is just nonsense.
Yes, people are losing their jobs. Oil and gasoline and food prices are going up. Mm-hmm. Consumption is falling. We have a severe housing recession. Millions are losing their homes. This is a severe economic and financial crisis.
A recession, though, I mean, sometimes these things happen and there are assumed to be flaws in an otherwise healthy market. But you specifically believe it's a recession, which suggests that there's something unhealthy about the system.
Yes, this recession was the result of mistaken policies. The Fed reduced interest rates last time around and kept it too low for too long, creating this housing and credit bubble. And mortgages that never should have occurred, did occur, and too much of them. And that created a housing bubble with home prices more than doubling in the last 10 years. And eventually this credit and housing bubble went bust. And now we have a consequence of it, a severe recession and a severe financial crisis when many banks are going to go belly up.
Is that some of what you were noticing in 2004?
Yes, at that time, those excesses were pretty clear. Interest rates were too low. There was really no regulation of the financial system. The Fed and Greenspan were cheerleading all this financial innovation. And, you know, the mortgage underwriting was utterly reckless. You know, you could buy a home with no down payment. There was no verification of your income, your assets, your jobs, these liar loans. You could have interest rate-only mortgages, not pay the principal. Teaser rates. So all this toxic stuff was occurring for subprime mortgages, for near prime, for home equity loans. And about 2/3 of all mortgage origination for the last 3 years had these really reckless characteristics.
But, you know, some people were arguing at the time that this was making home ownership possible for thousands, if not millions, of Americans, and that that actually has a salutary effect on communities and the economy.
That's true, but it became excessive, and now millions are losing their homes and communities are destroyed, and the consequences of the bust is that actually home ownership rates are going to sharply fall.
Personal question. I gather the answer to the question, where are you from, is not simple.
Yes, I'm quite international. My background, born in Turkey. A family is a Jewish family from Iran, so went from Turkey to Iran to Israel and then grew up in Italy, ended up in the U.S. for graduate school. So I tend to look at things from an international perspective, and I think that gives you a little bit of a broader view of what's going on.
Might give you a different set of sensitivities than some other economists?
Yes, we are at this point in a global economy that is fully integrated. No economy is anymore an island. So, for example, these toxic residential mortgage securities were created and ended up in the hand of investors even in small towns in the northern part of Norway, and now you have a financial crisis in some towns out there or in Australia or in Europe and so on. So now it's not just a U.S. recession. The latest numbers suggest that all advanced economies are entering a recession, and we might even have a global recession.
Dr. Roubini, it's been very good to talk to you.
A pleasure talking to you today.
New York University economist Noriel Roubini. And by the way, NPR profiled Mr. Roubini 3 years ago.